You are listening to South by Southwest Sessions.
Hey, South by Southwest, I'm Amy Webb, and I am so grateful to be here with you this year to share our annual list of emerging technology and science trends. Before I get started, I just want to say a brief note of thanks. I've been part of the South by community since 2005. It's been almost two decades. In that time, I've learned so much. I've met people who have become my closest friends. I've had some of the most memorable experiences of my life at South By. You know, South By isn't just a festival that happens once a year in Austin. It's a global community that enriches my life all year round and yours too. So I want to say thank you. This has been a rough year, and I am grateful that we're able to do this even with everything that's happening. So thank you to Sarah Lynn and Hugh Forrest and the production team that's making these virtual sessions possible. Thank you so much for everything that you do and for supporting the South By community in all the ways that you have. So for those of you in the South By community that I haven't had a chance to meet yet, here are the three things that I usually tell people when I introduce myself. I'm a quantitative futurist. I developed a foresight methodology that's used in hundreds of organizations around the world. It relies on quantitative and qualitative data to find signals of change and to model next order impacts. I teach this system at the NYU Stern School of Business. I founded the Future Today Institute, which is a data-driven, technology-led global futures organization. We're management consultants to Fortune 100 companies and government agencies, but we also collaborate with the creative community. So we work with writers and producers and showrunners on world building and all of the technology and science that they use in their shows and in their movies that are set in the future. Lastly, our work at FTI is open source. I believe very strongly in democratizing the tools of futurists so that everybody can do this work. So at the very end, I'm going to show you a link where you can download a bunch of free research and tools that you can start using right away. Last year, the world shut down the week of South By, and it's going to be remembered as the moment that our future histories took a divergent path, the moment that everything changed. We succeed or we learn. And in the past 12 months, we've had a lot of educational opportunities. When we think about the virus, a lot of countries around the world had 4 months of warning, 4 months of signals, showing them what was on the horizon before it hit. I mean, we had some time to prepare. When we look at the disastrous aftermath of the US election, there were clear signs for years that the fabric of society was fraying at the edges, and that the structural integrity of the center was being ripped apart. The signals of 2020 deserve to be foregrounded, but we need to get better at intercepting those signals of change earlier and taking some kind of action. And that's why I'm here with you, because I have some unsettling news for you. Surviving one global pandemic, one truly awful presidency, it doesn't make us immune from chaos in the future. These weren't necessarily once-in-a-century events. I mean, it could happen again. And if we have our eyes closed to the signals in front of us, it just might. Nobody can predict the future. It's mathematically impossible. And there is no such thing as future-proofing. Again, the math doesn't work out. There are way too many variables outside of any one person's control. And that's fine, because if we've learned anything in the past year, it's that we all need to be more flexible. We need to lean into uncertainty, but we can't do it blindly. We can get better, much better, at tracking forces, signals, and trends, and thinking about the implications, modeling what-if scenarios. And we can keep pushing forward to the future. You know, it's like the James Joyce quote from A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man: to live, to err, to fall, to triumph, to recreate life out of life. So I'm going to start today with a brief overview, and then we'll get to the trends and There's quite a few of them this year, as you're about to see. So when we model emerging trends at the Future Today Institute, we start with this framework. And at FTI, we call this our wheel of disruption. The 11 macro forces that you see on this wheel represent external uncertainties over which no one entity has control, but which play a critical role in how our futures develop. So that's what you see on the outside of the wheel. But because technology is intertwined with every aspect of modern life, it connects to all of those forces. So that's the next ring in. And closer to that, to the center, are signals. Signals indicate emerging change. There are weak signals and strong signals. Weak signals are a new technology development that hasn't yet hit the mainstream, or some kind of small innovation, or other minor developments that have the potential to grow as they mature, but you know, we'll still need some time. Strong signals, on the other hand, are more obvious. They're bigger innovations, significant developments, or big R&D advancements, or huge amounts of funding. These are obvious warning indicators telling us something is changing. Trends, which you see at the very center of this wheel of disruption, trends emerge from the intersection of macro forces and signals. They develop over longer periods of time. Forecasting longitudinal trends is what enables us to see change early and to identify risk and opportunity so that you can make better decisions. Surprises happen to companies and to countries when no one is at the wheel, when no one's at the wheel of disruption, monitoring what's happening and tracking signals of change. We spend too much time judging people by their answers rather than by the questions that they ask. Questions are important. They allow us to lean in to uncertainty about the future with our curiosity rather than our biases or our preconceptions. When futurists see emerging signals and trends, we ask a lot of questions. We ask questions about them, like, what new tensions result from these forces, signals, and trends? What are the new tensions inside of our company, in the industry? How are there new tensions in the regulatory environment? What about consumer tensions? What about tensions in our communities? What about society? We also ask questions about assumptions, like, what assumptions must hold true now for our current strategy to succeed? And finally, is there a way for us to resolve all of this? Can we resolve those tensions by leveraging the forces, signals, and trends to create alternative ideas about the future, even if those ideas challenge our cherished beliefs? Now it's more important than ever to ask these questions, because in the past year, there are thousands of new signals that have emerged. And that's why, with so much that's happened in the past year, the Future Today Institute did not write a tech trend report like we normally do. We wrote 12. Each volume of the report covers a different set of topics, ranging from artificial intelligence to transportation to consumer electronics and network infrastructure and all kinds of things related to genomic editing and biology. This is our 14th annual Tech Trend Report, and this year it's really big. We're covering close to 500 technology and science trends, which is up about 22% since last year. Primarily, this has to do with COVID-19. There were tremendous aftershocks, and that started to reverberate and change many different segments of the economy. It's also due to what we are calling the New World Disorder, which you're going to hear about in just a little bit. Each page of the Tech Trend Report has the same elements to help you navigate it easily. So there's a key insight explaining succinctly what that trend is, some examples to help you understand the contours and texture of that trend, our analysis of the disruptive impact that trend will have in the coming years, and then some emerging players. So rather than the usual suspects, I mean, everybody sort of knows who's working on AI at this point. So instead of that, we're listing the companies, the individual research teams, sometimes even the individual people that you're probably not aware of and should be tracking. There's a decision bar at the top, which indicates what type of action you should take, and the number of years that this trend has been on our list. Each volume has key findings summarized at the beginning. So each book is kind of like a little miniature TED Talk version to help you get a broad overview of how things have shifted and changed. And then inside, you will start to find, in addition to trends, some strategic guidance for four key groups of people in your organization. So there's key strategic guidance for everybody working in strategy, from your chief strategy officers and everybody who works on strategy teams. There's guidance specifically for innovation teams, so people working on innovation, product development, things like that, R&D units, and then finally those who work in risk. Now, obviously, this is intended to be useful across all divisions, which range from marketing to human resources and finance. So throughout the report, you'll find specific guidance for all of those different groups as well. Because there was so much disruption in the past year, we developed some roadmaps revealing how certain companies are repositioning themselves for the future. So for example, you'll find a pretty big section on Amazon's healthcare ambitions and what that means for everybody else. We also have dozens of scenarios, as we always do. These are evidence-based stories about the future. And again, they're not speculative, they're strategic. They are intended to help you understand possible outcomes of all of these trends in the future. It's free, so this is open source, it's available for you to download, and we invite you to build on it and make it your own. So today, I'm going to reveal three key findings and take a deep dive with you into some related tech trend clusters. It's a lot, and I can assure you that as we do this, some of these things are going to feel very disconnected. So I'm going to invite you to be patient and try to follow along with me, because at the very end, I'm going to connect all of these seemingly disparate dots for you and reveal future scenarios so that we can explore what is now recently plausible. So we'll start with the key finding number one. Your body is part of a network called the U of Things, and that network, that U of Things, is becoming sentient. You can think of the U of Things as a sort of biological BIOS, a basic input-output system where our bodies, devices, and a network all interact. The U of Things technologies broadly fall under the Internet of Things, the IoT umbrella, but in many ways, it's just much, much more intimate. So the trends in this section mostly come from the volumes of our trend report on home automation, consumer electronics, and health, but you're gonna see how all of these things fit together momentarily. So we'll start with the things that you'll be wearing, embedding, or simply using with your body pretty soon. At South By in 2018, one of our key findings that year was that it was the beginning of the end of smartphones. And I explained that if we all hopped in a time machine and went back to 1998 and said, listen, within two decades, all these devices, your portable DVD player, your mini disc player, your digital camera, all that functionality is going to be encompassed in a single portable computer called a smartphone. You would have laughed, right? And yet, here we are. That analysis from a couple of years ago is holding true. In general, new smartphone sales are down year over year, and not just in the United States. This makes sense. There's just not a lot of compelling new features or functionality that's coming in our all-in-one smartphone devices. So we're transitioning away from that. It's a different paradigm, from a single phone to a new constellation of devices that we will either wear or embed. So one of the things that's coming over the next 18 to 24 months is smart glasses. Smart glasses have some of the functionality that we currently have on our smartphones overlaid in our vision. And we'll also still have the ability with smart glasses to make phone calls and talk to people, perhaps using an earpiece in the temple of the frame of the glasses that we have. But there's a bunch of other stuff out there. Some people are already using these devices. So there are wristbands that can detect emotion, rings that we can wear that know our blood oxygen level. earbuds that can sense our temperature, and a whole bunch of other devices that correlate our biometric data with our behaviors in the real world. You're going to start to see now new form factors that result as all of these devices start to come to market. One of the things that you'll see are more flexible screens, rollable screens. This Oppo that you see is an example of a rollable phone versus a foldable phone, which is what everybody was talking about last year. In this particular rollable, an OLED display widens from around 6.7 inches to become as large as 7.4 inches. So it kind of expands outward. But it does this using a rolling mechanism. And this allows users to adjust the size of the screen as they need. Rollables are possible because of our new array of flexible sensors and displays that have just become easier to manufacture. Here's another interesting flexible interface design. So it turns out Amazon patented a system to track ultrasonic pulses on our wrists. This is designed to track and record workers' locations right down to their hand movements. So if the wristband senses a lull in somebody's productivity, it would sort of vibrate and nudge them. Okay, that's fine. Or perhaps if somebody's working in a warehouse, it would connect to a pacing robot that is stationed just in front of that worker. And maybe that pacing robot would sense that the worker's not as productive as they could be, and it would force the worker to pick up the pace and start going faster. You know, all of this gives employers highly personal information, not just where somebody is in the building, but also what they're doing, like taking a bathroom break. And if you're tracking hand movements, which ostensibly these things are designed to do, I guess you would know what direction somebody is wiping in. In the U of things, implantable devices are another area where we're starting to see accelerated movement. Already there are implantable smart cardiac devices, so insulated wires that connect to the heart and transmit that information from you to your home and then out to some, you know, doctor somewhere. But what you see here is an example of something. It's like the next thing, something a little different. This is a new type of closed circuit loop. In this closed circuit, the body is its own secure wireless channel. Theoretically, this makes your body less hackable. Bodies are hackable, you say? Yes, this is important because a few years ago, a hacker demonstrated how easily it was to remotely attack an implanted medical device like a pacemaker. So several companies are now in this space. They're thinking about closed loop systems and, you know, bodies themselves as networks. And some of those companies include Neuralink, which has been in the news a lot, but also Facebook. They're building BCIs, brain-controlled interfaces, which are intended to remove the physical barriers between humans and machines. Our current intermediary in the human-machine space is our voice, right? So we can speak to command machines and systems. But the idea here is, what if we didn't have to bother speaking at all in a way that's another barrier, right? And instead we simply thought our commands to machines and those machines responded. So the U of things makes use of behavioral biometrics, which mine hundreds of unique biometric data points from the devices that we wear, compare those data points against our individual baselines, use machine learning and deep learning to learn and understand more about us for the purpose of authenticating us, nudging us, rewarding us, or punishing us, as the case may be. In the U of things, these devices are becoming smart. So for example, this is an example of smart sleep technology. So bear with me here. So this thing is called the Uller. It's a fitted sheet that has wires and tubes running all throughout it. And science says that you get a more restful, deep, peaceful sleep if you can keep your room at a fairly low temperature. So rather than cranking up your air conditioning and making sure that your room is 60 degrees at night, the idea here is instead they just chill the bed. So this thing chills your bed down before you get into it, and then it automatically adjusts your body temperature for you while you sleep. And to wake you up, it cranks up the heat. Your body gets hot, your brain kind of reacts and turns on, and then you're up without an alarm clock. Actually, sleep tech is a new frontier in the home automation space and in the you of things space. And it's interesting, right? I mean, on the one hand, this is about optimizing your sleep so that you can rest and repair. On the other hand, you kind of have to give yourself over to a machine while you're unconscious and hope that the machine is doing the right thing, making decisions for you. This is a little robot that mimics the heartbeat and warmth of another person, and it sends signals while you sleep to your limbic system, which results in your heart beating faster or slower, changes the depth of your breath in order, again, to help you get a more restful, peaceful sleep. There are devices that reward and punish you for getting stressed out. So this thing that you're looking at looks like a vape pen. It's actually a breathing device. It tracks and analyzes your metabolism throughout the day. And then it tells you, based on what your metabolism is, what to eat. So more carbs, fewer carbs, more water, you know, whatever. Now, metabolism is linked to stress. So this becomes a little bit of a vicious cycle, because if you start getting stressed out about your carbs, and then it orders you to eat fewer carbs, but now you're stressed out and you're breathing into this pen all day long, you know, I don't know if that's going to accomplish for you what you needed to. In the you of things, devices are talking to each other over local networks, which may or may not be secure depending on where your body is plugged in. This kitchen faucet responds to voice. So you can ask it for 3 cups of water and it'll automatically dispense exactly the right amount, which is pretty amazing. I'm a complete mess in the kitchen. I tend to get myself messy and everything around me. So I love the idea of being able to tell the faucet to pour exactly the right amount of water into something so I don't, you know, get the faucet all dirty. It's also a really great way for a hacker to cause a flood in your kitchen when you're asleep or when you're on vacation. This is a medical grade COVID scanner that automatically unlocks doors. So it performs an automatic temperature check and it displays the temperature back to the user. An LED panel will glow red if the visitor has a fever, and the system will refuse to unlock the door. It'll refuse her entry. It can also be programmed to limit the capacity of entrance. So when the capacity, you know, of wherever you happen to be or your house, when that capacity hits, the door won't unlock, even if that person has been temperature cleared, and even if that person is you and it's your home. This is interesting. So this is a smart toilet, and it kind of sort of has what I would call high-tech fecal vision. So this is a strong signal because it represents a contradiction. Do you really want a toilet filled with scanners that recognize your personal and particular, you know, anatomy? I mean, actually, I think this thing's pretty cool. Imagine every single time you go to the bathroom, you effectively have a doctorless exam. You know, I mean, think of how amazing that could be. So COVID-19 has accelerated telemedicine, home-based lab tests, and the push to standardize electronic health records and digital ID systems. These systems are intended to connect you and your data with the internet and ultimately with others. The you of things connects your body to a network and that network to third parties. So here's another way that works. This is a garbage scanner. It's a little device that attaches to a garbage can and scans everything you throw away. And then, depending on how you configure it, it might reorder automatically something from Amazon. So if you throw away a box of Triscuits, a new one will show up, new box will show up the following day. But this does make me wonder, how will Amazon integrate personal data from the kitchen into the rest of its ecosystem? I mean, maybe in the future it reorders things, which is nice, but it could potentially also auto-report you for not recycling or for throwing away perfectly good food. We are also seeing the emergence of neighborhood mesh networks. So a mesh network is a group of devices located within close proximity that allows for fast and efficient data routing. Amazon has this program called Sidewalk in the United States. It's a location tracking mesh network that operates at the scale of a network of a neighborhood. So for every device within Sidewalk that's turned on, internet bandwidth gets pooled for about a half mile. If your body is in the mesh, if you lose your keys, if you lose your kid, the mesh will help locate it for you. So these are just a handful of ideas, but again, let's think things through. There aren't a ton of companies that are the primary operating systems for the you of things. I mean, unsurprisingly, they tend to be the familiar names that we know and expect. All of these devices, all of these things, at some point are routed through Google, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, and Facebook. And in China, of course, it's Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. All of this connects to the cloud, all of these things do, where decisions are being made automatically. And that includes inferences about who we are and what we want. New research from Queen Mary University in London demonstrated a neural network that can mine and refine human emotion using these different devices, using this data, and accurately determine somebody's emotional state at any given time. Now imagine a system that knows your typical baselines, knows subtle changes in your emotional state all of the time, and connects your body to a recommendation engine. I mean, Spotify might, at some point, just automatically change the channel to cheer you up if it detects that you're feeling bad. But maybe you want to feel really bad. Maybe your like fifth hour listening to The Cure is exactly what you need at that point. You would lose the ability to have some autonomy in making that decision. Or, you know, maybe you're connected to digital advertising that will show you ads when you have the highest probability of being receptive. Or a dynamic pricing system that would make determinations for you based on your real-time emotions, your biometric data, and your typical behaviors. Okay, so in this first cluster of trends related to this key finding, to the you of things, we went through a whole bunch of different examples. And now we got to do what I asked you to do at the very beginning, to lean into uncertainty by asking questions. So let's ask a bunch of questions because I know I have a whole bunch. And let's think about next order impacts. Does the you of things make healthcare the next big battleground for big tech companies? And if so, our current antitrust conversations are going to seem a little bit like fighting yesterday's war. Where do we now see new opportunities and threats that didn't exist before? And then there are some more practical questions like, you know, certain states in the United States, like Illinois and California, have very strict privacy laws. If your body is plugged into the you of things, would it be illegal for you to cross state lines? Maybe. How secure is the you of things? How would we know? Who owns the data? Can we prevent our data from being seen by a third party if we don't want it to? What assumptions do you now have to challenge about what you think about the future? And where are there new resolutions that address these tensions and these assumptions so that we can move forward in a way that delivers a future we want? All right, so that's one key finding, one set of tech trends. Let's now move on to the second key finding and the second set of tech trends. So our second key finding is you are living in a mixed reality world. The you of things and your personal data now create what you perceive as reality. So there's a lot of important strategic trends in this section. And so I'm going to mostly pull from the volumes that we have on AI, new realities, privacy and security, and algorithmic scoring. So one thing we know to be true, the digital and physical realms are intertwining in new and unexpected ways. The you of things, your personal data, are being mined and refined to influence what you perceive as your reality. There are different types of realities. You already know all about virtual reality and augmented reality, so I'm not going to talk about that. Instead, I'd like to talk to you about other types of realities, what we call assistive reality and diminished reality. Assistive reality uses digital elements to sort of help you get through the physical world. This would be something like a GPS device on your car, I mean, the kinds of things you're already pretty used to. But my favorite example of something new has to do with how we hijack sound and use sound to alter our realities. So at the end of last year, when everybody was looking at their top songs or top playlists on Spotify, turns out my top song was Brown Noise. It kind of sounds like static. And I actually listen to Brown Noise all day long, anytime I'm working. Sound has two fundamental characteristics: frequency, which is how fast the waveform is vibrating per second, and then amplitude, which sort of describes the size of the waves. So you've heard of white noise. Well, if you adjust the frequency and amplitude, you get to different types of noise, which are kind of loosely named using an analogy for light. White noise has got all the frequencies. Pink mostly focuses on the higher end, and brown noise, it's actually Brownian motion in physics, is a sort of deeper version of pink. Now, depending on your neurological wiring, this is a way to hack your neural pathways. In my case, brown noise is kind of like a digital version of Adderall. It makes me super laser focused, but kind of relaxed. And when I work on brown noise, when I'm wired in, I do amazing work. But when it's time for me to go to sleep, I change the frequency down to pink, which studies show help to improve memory, retention, and rehabilitation. All right, so now that you know that noise isn't just noise, what other sounds do you think you might be missing? So one assistive reality device is this little box that you see. Now, a while ago, researchers developed a tiny speaker that emits a super high-pitched sound. It's called the mosquito. If you're my age, you wouldn't hear it. It's a frequency that just the youth can hear, just younger people and teenagers. In Philadelphia, city officials put these speakers at a whole bunch of rec centers and public parks as a kind of mosquito repellent, except that the mosquitoes were teenagers. There's another assistive reality technology, and this is a prescription strength video game. In June of last year, June 2020, the FDA approved Endeavor RX. This is a first-person racing game that was built by a neuroscientist at the University of California, San Francisco. This game has been through various rounds of peer review, and it has shown that it significantly improves clinical markers of attention in patients with ADHD. It looks like a little kid's video game, but it's not. The stimuli were actually designed to target and activate the prefrontal cortex. And as gameplay progresses, it adapts to personalized treatment. You can't play this game unless you have a prescription. There's another game, The Guardians Unite the Realms, that was designed by Harvard and MIT researchers to address behavioral activation therapy. It's a form of treatment for depression. And this game, again, as you play it, it adapts and it serves to break rumination loops. So that's assistive reality. Now there's another form of reality that one of my FTI colleagues, Mark Palatucci, he calls it diminished reality. And the way that he describes it is, it kind of takes away stimuli. So it takes away something in your field of vision, it changes or dampens the sound, it might even change the way that you physically sense the world around you. So diminished reality. And this is an example. So this is a noise-canceling window. So if you've ever used noise-canceling headsets, you're familiar with diminished reality, or DR. But this is DR without having to plug directly in. So this is a noise-canceling window. Researchers in Singapore embedded sensors in windows that can automatically recognize the waves and the frequency of a sound. So like a bunch of honking trucks outside of your window, and then generate a mirror sound of it. They emit the second wave, an anti-wave, from a speaker, which effectively offsets that sound and sort of cancels it out and makes it go away. Where our office is in Lower Manhattan, you can see the little FTI logo there on the map. It would be very, very nice to have noise-canceling windows because it is extremely loud. And I could imagine noise-canceling windows starting to change real estate or how cars and trains and planes are built. I mean, we could redesign the future of auditoriums, of restaurants. Basically, any place where glass would have been a problem before because it reflected too much noise back, you could now use. I could also imagine a future in which we have diminished reality buildings, not just windows, but entire buildings, where the buildings themselves dampen the noise of a city. So in diminished reality, you can take things away from your field of view. So if you look on the left, that's a table and chairs and some other stuff in the room. And on the right, a DR application has removed a bunch of elements from view in real time, which means that there are some interesting things on our horizon, potentially. I mean, can you imagine people canceling glasses? That's right. Our AR glasses will both add and subtract visual elements. I mean, imagine going to a restaurant. Imagine being in a restaurant and going into visual DR mode. You know, you're there with your partner, you're having a lovely evening, and then there's some, you know, dude sitting next to you who orders a well-done steak and then like smothers it in ketchup and then chews with his teeny tiny little hands, tiny little mouth wide open. You're like, who wants to see that ever, right? Imagine being able to visually disconnect from that reality, to turn out the lights, to cancel that in real time and just remove him from your field of view. And if you have assistive audio, either in the temple of those glasses or in the form of earbuds, you could also turn down the volume on his completely inane conversation. Instead, you could still connect to the restaurant's, you know, ambient sound so you can hear your partner without having to give any attention to that situation that's happening next to you. All of this sounds amazing, at least to me, but it does raise some important questions, like, what if we choose to visually cancel garbage on the street rather than picking it up? What if we visually cancel the homeless rather than interacting with them? Does diminished reality at some point desensitize us to actual reality? And what would that mean? Last year, I talked about synthetic media, and we've been covering it in our research now for years. There's been a lot of development in that space, so I want to show you some updates. So synthetic media, if you're not yet familiar, it's created using artificial intelligence. Algorithms begin with an initial set of data to learn. So this can be faces, voices, landscapes, people, objects, gestures, motions, text, other types of information, other types of details. And then systems learn over time and automatically generate content. So the end result is a realistic looking and a very realistic sounding artificial digital person. And there are all kinds of examples, from voice clones to interactive bots. In fact, what you see on your screen, that's Shudu, and she is beautiful and compelling, and she's not real. But she's not quite an intelligent bot. She's more like a cheap fake. And she's synthetic, but she's media that's being generated with the help of people. And she doesn't entirely evolve as she grows. This is Akira. I built Akira in 2016 as a digital extension of myself. Akira is non-binary, and they don't have a synthetic body, but they did, over time, learn and evolve. And we've come a long way in the past 5 years that I've been screwing around with this technology. This is a digital extension of Deepak Chopra that uses your interactions with him to learn. And he even has a moving face and a mouth. I mean, it looks a little janky, but you know, it's another step forward in that direction. I mean, it's getting really easy to synth voices and experiences. If you have a big enough corpus of data, then you can program a synthetic version of like anyone you want and train them to have conversations with you. As an example, not that I'm doing this in my spare time, but one could synthesize international treasure and living goddess Phoebe Waller-Bridge and train her to become your best friend. Again, not that I'm doing this at all in my spare time, but if you wanted to do that, you certainly could. There are new marketplaces now where you can go to buy and sell synths. This is an example of one. It's Synthasia. It's as easy as writing an email. Basically, you go in, you type in what you want the bot to say, what you want the synthetic character to say, and then it says it, but it also learns. That makes it really interesting when you think about corporate training, for example. Imagine a corporate training video that you could personalize with your employees' details, like their name and their role and some other, you know, interesting facets of their life. Yes, it's a cool way to customize, but there's also a body of research showing that personal details are behavioral triggers, which means that a synth could earn trust and keep people paying attention. You could engineer likability in a way that a real human can't do on their own. And this ties into this growing body of work in artificial intelligence, like emotion detection and interpretation and mirroring. This is another marketplace. This is Alethea, where you can buy synths. And here's an example where you could buy a mashup of Donald Trump and Joe Exotic, called Don Exotic. And you could have him say whatever you want. You can synth various parts of your real world existence in a way that makes people not really see a clear boundary between who is the real you and which parts of you are synthetic. And you don't have to synth the whole person. So one interesting example is the emergence of digital fashion, which we're starting to see bubble up, and especially that happened over the past year. You know, you can buy digital clothing, have it digitally tailored for you, and then wear it in real time in your social media interactions, or wear it for your Insta, Snap, you know, TikTok posts. And it ranges from things like, you know, clearly sort of gamified looking, you know, sweaters, but also wedding dresses. Some people who weren't able to get married during the pandemic bought digital dresses for weddings so that they had wedding photos, but they didn't have to go through the expense of setting all of that up since the whole thing was virtual. You can now also synthesize former parts of you as well. So steady yourselves, because this one is going to sound problematic. Microsoft patented some software that will reincarnate dead people as living chatbots. And basically the program works by pulling in data from their social media posts and text messages and things like that. And then it creates a living, breathing, digital, synthetic person and allows you or anybody that you want to have a conversation with them. All right, so talk through lots of different trends here that meld your physical and your digital worlds. And so again, we need to lean into what all of this means by asking questions, questions about what might happen next. So let's begin with practical and then we'll go on to existential. It seems natural that mixed reality transactions are on the horizon. So what does that tell us about your company? Is your company prepared for people to start tagging, saving, and transacting seamlessly in mixed reality? What happens when you can pay just with yourself and you don't need to have any other things on you? How does mixed reality start to change your value chain? How does it change what we know about SEO? If your employees create digital extensions of themselves and those digital extensions break company rules, what is your protocol? Especially if the synthetic version of that person was doing things that didn't have to do with the company or weren't operating on company time. And now some more existential questions. You know, we have to start addressing IP here, and I'm not the first person to ask the question, who owns your face? But we don't have an answer to that question yet, and it's gonna take a while for our laws to catch up with technology. What happens if somebody synths you? What happens if somebody synths me, right? And you don't have control over what happens next? What happens if you die? Are the conversations that you have as a synth after you die reflective of the person that you were when you were alive? And if not, what does that mean? What does trust look like in an age of altered reality? I mean, we have to start confronting a very deeply held belief here that photos and videos are trustable, reliable, accurate records of reality when we know now that they may not be. And what do we do about deep catfishing? That's a term that we haven't yet used and you'll probably start hearing about. I mean, what happens if somebody synths your identity or some fake identity or their own identity and puts it out into the world in order to manipulate people? You know, what happens in that case? It's actually happened a few times already in different ways. How are you going to manage this coming digital divides where some people have digital extensions and other people don't? And of course, where do you start to see new tensions? What assumptions about what you're doing, whether it's your business or your life, what assumptions have to hold true into the future to make sure that you succeed? And how are you going to resolve those tensions and resolutions before the future arrives? Okay, so we've gone through two key findings, a whole bunch of trends. So let's now move on to our final set of trends and our third key finding. So the third key finding is that 2020 resulted in a new world disorder. The U of things and mixed reality shifted our expectations about power. The events of the past year have definitely played a role too. So the trends in this section have to do with our volumes on artificial intelligence and blockchain and distributed ledgers and cryptos, as well as government tech and even synthetic biology and genomic editing. COVID has drastically shifted the balance of power in many, many different ways. One COVID aftershock has to do with surveillance. Surveillance has become much more acceptable than it was previously. In China, technologies have been used by, you know, both the government and by everyday people to enforce quarantines. This is a picture of a woman who was out in the street being harassed by a drone. A citizen was flying a drone around, barking orders at other citizens to obey him at the start of the coronavirus pandemic. And listen, you know, the guy had a good idea. You know, people are walking around outside without face masks and talking to each other and potentially spreading more of the virus. But here's an individual that has taken matters into his own hands and dictating, you know, what happens. Here in the United States, in Westport, Connecticut, the city was evaluating a new type of camera system, a specialized sensor and computer vision system that from a very far distance away could detect fever, measure heart and respiratory rates, and identify whether people are coughing or sneezing or practicing social distancing correctly. They were doing this using smart cameras that were positioned very far out of sight, like the length of a soccer pitch or a football field away. This system didn't get implemented once people found out about it, but the point is, like, we got pretty, you know, they got pretty far into that conversation. For many of us, myself included, in order for us to send our kids to school, we now have to fill out a daily medical chart. This is actually my daughter's chart. It's her school, and we have to show this green pass in order to drop her off. And in order to get the green pass, we have to answer very detailed personal information about ourselves. And not just her, but everybody that she comes into contact with. I have no idea who's on the other end of that application. I don't know where it's managed. I don't know whether it's encrypted. I don't know whether at some point could be released to a third party. I have no clue, but I really want my child to be educated, so I don't have a choice. New digital ID systems are coming. They are going into effect all around the world at national levels. And for good reason. We don't want the virus to continue to spread. And there's not enough people taking precautions like wearing your stupid mask and adopting social distancing practices. However, the one trend that's emerged from all of this is national tracking in a very different way. So it's not just where you're going and perhaps who you're going with and maybe even why you're going to that place, but now using all of those sensor data, the information about your body. So we're going to start seeing digital vaccine passports, which will likely be required for us to start traveling freely again. We're submitting to surveillance, and we are starting to see new forms of activism that use digital tools that are enabled by the digital surveillance. We can call it hacktivism. It's not the first time that this has happened in society. If you remember the Occupy Wall Street movement that started in New York, but kind of became a worldwide phenomenon, you know, we used platforms to get the word out, text messaging services and social networks, but this time around, there are more tools, more technology, and we're seeing more multidimensional hacktivism. You know, over the past year, the central compacts of society have completely broken down in many places around the world. COVID forced us apart physically, but it also drove us together in new ways online. In the aftermath of the insurrection at the Capitol, hacktivists have gotten together to identify who was there. A low point in American democracy turned out to cause a huge acceleration, a sort of high point for recognition algorithms and the acceptance of citizen surveillance. Bellingcat is an open source investigation agency. And it unites people who are on the West Coast and as far as South America and even Australia, and brings them together to try to find people doing bad stuff. This uses machine learning tools and facial recognition algorithms, in this case, to analyze photos into videos. And they're hoping to identify the most violent protesters that were at the insurrection. And what they're doing is building digital dossiers on those people, and they're handing this information over to the FBI. The tools that are in use, anybody can get access to now. Computer vision systems, recognition algorithms, image enhancement tools, location stamps, maps. And what we're seeing is the birth of a new form of pro-am digital forensics, which is certainly useful. But what are the reverberating effects here? What are we not thinking about? We know that algorithms used everywhere around the world are riddled with bias. I am not the first person to tell you that. They do a terrible job of recognizing people of color. And nearly a year ago to the day of the Capitol insurrection, Detroit police officers arrested a black man because of a snafu with a facial recognition algorithm. The algorithm said he was a criminal. There was a theft. They accused him of being the thief and arrested him, all because of an errant AI system. That's what makes some of what we're starting to see scary. This is the Faces of the Riot website, and it, to me, is concerning because it was built using videos scraped from Parler, which, as you probably now know, is the far-right social media website where horrible lies and misinformation were spread. However, the data from that site, the data from the dump of Parler, now has 6,000 images of people. If you click on any face that's there, you can get to a video that appeared that somebody took during the riots at the Capitol, during the insurrection, like this guy. Now, most of the people who were there, who were posting all of these videos, were doing horribly, awful, terrible things. But some of the people in these videos just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. They were ambient data in the background of the video that somebody else was taking. You know, there's an old saying in online forums, pics or it didn't happen. It's a way of saying that nobody will believe you unless they see photographic proof. So what happens when we have pics and it didn't happen? I mean, what happens if you're an ambient bit of data floating around in somebody else's video and a system makes inferences about you? We saw coordinated attacks in new ways in the past year. GameStop's stock skyrocketed because of hacktivism. But because of Reddit and gaming culture, where people who grew up playing massively multiplayer games knew how to build and execute coordinated attacks, you know, that totally changed the nature of what happened. In this case, the attack influenced the financial market. In the middle of GameStop's stock soaring, Robinhood, which traders were using to force the price up, halted trading. It was an example of something that I call a CDOS attack, a corporate denial of service. And we actually saw a lot of CDOS activity at the end of last year. You know, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, they finally removed a lot of bad accounts that were intentionally spreading lies and misinformation. AWS removed Parler from its hosting services. You know, and all of that happened outside of government agencies. You know, not too long ago, Molly Wood, who is a brilliant technology reporter and who you should be paying a lot of attention to, she started asking a provocative question, and it was this. You know, just a few powerful companies now control the cloud, which gives them the unilateral ability to run to turn services on or off and to potentially throttle traffic too. Molly calls this cloud neutrality. And she's using the analogy of network neutrality to describe what happens when power gets consolidated to just a few players in a way that has a broader impact on all of society. How are decisions being made to CDOS other businesses? All right, so now I'd like to transition to another set of trends. This is going to be the last one, which are going to seem very disconnected from everything else that I've been talking about, but they are very much related to how information moves around. And these trends also show us that sometimes when order is disrupted, good things result. These trends have to do with synthetic biology. We've transitioned from natural selection to artificial selection to intentional design. The era of synthetic biology is now here. Synthetic biology is a new field of science that involves redesigning organisms for different purposes. Scientists engineer them for new capabilities. Synthetic biology will allow us to read genomes, edit genetic data, and importantly, write a new code for life, for living organisms, which means that soon we will program living biological structures as though they were tiny computers. COVID-19 vaccines that we're all very excited about, they make use of engineered code, a form of messenger RNA. The vaccines don't contain attenuated or weakened forms of the virus. Instead, they contain biological code to overwrite your body's natural responses. This thing that you see on your screen is a printer. It actually prints out new DNA. It can print out a synthetic virus. It can print out a synthetic genome. And what's amazing is that you can write your code in one place and send it to a printer located somewhere else, which means that in the next decade, we could have printers on Mars. Rather than carrying heavy payloads to space with trees and plants and animals, instead, we would just have a couple of printers, install the printers, and then email whatever it was that we needed. We could email an apple orchard to the settlers. We could send biological code for an apple tree, print it out, and grow all the juicy, delicious apples that you want. And even better, the code could be tweaked for Martian climate or for Martian gravity. And future Martians could email their code back to Earthers. And here on Earth, we could print out Martian tomatoes or other Martian exotic agriculture. I know this sounds fantastical, but advancements in synthetic biology are rapidly disordering the way that we think about life, the way that we engineer life. And that's a good thing. It means that we're looking at a future potentially with universal vaccines that help us deal with the next set of pandemics. It means that potentially in the future, we are self-healing humans. So all of these trends, they're all part of this new world disorder that has emerged. They influence how information moves around, how our businesses operate, and the social constructs that we will abide by in the future. Okay, and so questions. What is the role of institutions in all of this? This is a really big one because it wasn't the SEC that shut down the trading of GameStop, and it wasn't the FCC that deplatformed all of those people spreading all of those lies. The FCC didn't deplatform Parler. It was private companies that made these decisions. In the United States, the big tech companies exerted power in a way that revealed a new balance of power and called into question whether our institutions need to be redesigned so that they can act more quickly. What do we do about all of this? And what do we do about trust? What about intellectual property rights, especially when it comes to something like synthetic biology? I'm asking that question because this is an image of a bacteria, and it's the genome of this particular bacteria was created from scratch by a team of researchers. They created the genome, inserted it into a cell, and booted up the cell just like you would boot up a computer, and in the process gave birth to the world's first synthetic life form. It was a breakthrough of basic science, and believe it or not, this particular bacteria is connected to that James Joyce quote that I began with at the start of all of this. That bacteria was digitally watermarked. Scientists, when they engineer things, they have to use watermarks on their creatures to distinguish what is engineered life from what is natural life. And the genetic code of this particular bacteria you're looking at says the words to live, to err, to fall, to triumph, to recreate life out of life. Now, it turns out that the Joyce estate is very litigious. When they found out that somebody had used a Joyce quote without their express permission, they went bananas. They sent an angry letter claiming that researchers should be given permission first before they used the line. But there's no way to send legal notice. Why? Because there's no language in any legislation covering copyright law when it comes to embedding information in DNA. And that means we have more questions to ask. If we can use DNA as a kind of biological backup drive, what happens if somebody copies the information and then distributes that copyrighted work biologically? We have no laws, we've got no regulation, we've got no way to think about that right now. And of course, there are existential questions like, who gets to make these decisions? Who decides what direction life is going to take? And who should have the right to edit the source code of all of humanity? And what is it going to mean to give birth in the future, to create life in the future? So we've gone through three clusters of trends. And I've shown you lots of different ideas, and we've asked lots of different questions. And we've talked about three findings today and some provocative questions that follow. So I'd like to end, as I always do, answering some of those questions in the form of scenarios. Scenarios are a tool that futurists use to explain what's plausible. They are rooted in data and evidence, and they're intended to be strategic, not purely speculative. So I'm going to start with the catastrophic framing, which takes us about 15 years into the future. So here we go. There is no more doctor's visit. There's no doctor's waiting room. That's because your body is data. It's monitored all the time. You have doctorless exams every single time you sit down on a toilet. Your garbage can judges you by what you throw away. Your wristband knows how stressed out you are. For wealthy people, this is actually all a good thing. Super rich people have opted in to the U of things because it's all private for them. The information is shared with elite doctors' practices who guarantee absolute privacy and discretion. Wealthy people are being optimized in real time. Adjustments are being made to their body temperature, their electrolytes, the sounds that they hear, the things that they see. For them, their body is a wonderland, and they can be expected now to live 10, 15 years longer than everybody else. Speaking of everybody else, there was no choice but to submit your data to being scraped so that you could potentially qualify for medical benefits. Every part of your day is being monitored, and you find yourself being punished for choices that used to be mundane and routine. If you throw away a bag of processed food, a bag of chips, a bag of carrots shows up the following day, and your wristband and your metabolism device check to make sure that you've eaten those carrots, because if you don't, you'll have to pay a little bit more for your insurance. This was super annoying. So you hacked the garbage scanner, but since the garbage scanner is connected to city services, you've now been denied garbage pickup. So now you've just got garbage piling up in your garage and in your house. There is no more sleeping until 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a weekend. Your bed starts cooking you until it senses that you're out and you're making contributions to society. And you could forget about being anonymous. No. All those pictures, all those videos that you posted, everything that you do is continually being watched and scored, and you're not even sure how to behave anymore. For you, your body isn't a wonderland. Your body is a prison for which there is no escape. Working from home now means continual productivity tracking, sleep monitoring. Nothing about your life is optimized. Nothing about what's optimized feels optimal. But you count yourself lucky, because in other parts of the world, these tools are used for even worse oppression. History is now auto-incorrected. We marvel at how simplistic the deepfakes of 2021 were. We've resurrected people, and we've put words into their mouths, clouding our memories of the way that they lived and how they actually were when they were alive. In fact, now, we can't entirely remember why we were so mad at our politicians in the year 2021. With their digital extensions scrubbed, they seem like reasonable, rational people. I mean, maybe we just all overreacted a little bit. Our activism, on the other hand, morphed into something vile and a little bit more difficult to comprehend. We chose digital aggression over the harder task of fixing problems in society. Today, people are divided. They're angrier. Our bubbles have hard outer shells and it's impossible to penetrate or pierce them. We blame the year 2020 as the cause of all of our problems now in the year 2036. But we also wish we'd made better choices. So you've probably noticed this year that there's not an optimistic scenario. It's not because I think doom and gloom is ahead. That's actually not why. It's instead because I think we're in the middle of a great transformation, and we have work to do. We know what a dystopian future looks like. We just lived through it. We know from today's signals that there are problems on the horizon. So our job right now is transformation, and I think that's starting to happen. But we have to commit to tracking signals. Businesses, you have to make room for ambiguity. You have to stop trying to future-proof yourselves. Future-proofing is brittle and it doesn't work. You have to track signals all the time. It's not a one-and-done deal. You have to create scenarios regularly and you have to be willing to recalibrate them, not once every few years. You have to develop models that show plausible outcomes of your decisions so that when you release a product, you already know in advance the type of impact on society that it could have. And lawmakers, it is time to step up. You cannot ignore politically unpopular ideas until there's a crisis. You have to be willing to invest in the longer term. You are public servants. If you are not willing to make decisions that benefit the future public good, you should not be running for office. And for everybody else, this moment of transformation is about you. I'm asking you to imagine yourself in the future, to be aspirational about the future, even if it scares you. Because imagining yourself in the future, that requires courage. But taking action on that future, that's a radical act. And that's what bold visionaries do. That's what you're going to do. Our collective action today, right now, that's the optimistic framing. That's the optimistic scenario. We're at the end. I've walked you through a whole bunch of different tech trends. We've talked about different key findings. I talked to you about our annual reports. Our bodies are connected to the U of Things. That U of Things is becoming sentient. Our digital and physical realms are intertwining. The U of Things, your personal data, they're being mined and refined to influence reality. 2020 resulted in a new world disorder. The U of Things and mixed reality shifted our expectations and our realities when it comes to power, but this is just scraping the surface. I intentionally talked about trends that cut across different industries and talked about different technologies because you have to be willing to look for the convergence of signals and trends outside of your usual field of view. The transformation is upon us, and I want you to get started right now. So, as I mentioned at the top, here's a link. There's a ton of free stuff. All of our reports, all of our information, everything is in there for you to download. Please take this information, read this information, discuss it, make it your own. Do not try to predict the future. It's not worth it, okay? Instead, focus on preparing your organizations and yourself for the future using signals and trends so that you can make better decisions. Let's make sure that history records this moment as the time that we decided to make better choices about our futures. Thank you so much. I will see you next year.